General Hackett Realfall.
Operation Market Garden, in which the 1st Airborne Division, in which I was commanding the 4th Parachute Brigade, took part in the Arnhem bridgehead operation, the top end of it, showed several examples of things that might have gone better, didn't go as well as they should. The airborne movement in Britain was very, very highly skilled in the deployment of an airborne force in a battle zone. They did it very, very well. But there wasn't the same degree of expertise in determining and controlling what happened, what was to happen after the landing was complete, after the deployment was carried out. I used to think rather unkindly that there was quite a high degree of what I used to call boy scouting in airborne troops in Britain. Enthusiasm, but not always a great deal of experience to back it up. And really quite a lot of them had never been anywhere near a battle before. And they weren't all that good at determining what had to happen. Now this 1st Airborne Division was probably the best fighting formation that there was in the British Army at that time. And after he got back from abroad, from the Mediterranean, and were preparing for what the soldiers laughingly called the bloodbath, we had to plan for 12 or so operations which never happened. Some only got as far as the planning stage, which were several, three as far as I remember. We were actually in our aeroplanes waiting to take off, with all the last-minute arrangements being made, the letters sent out, the disposition of families and so on. All this had been done, and you'd be sitting in the aeroplane waiting to go to the battle, and somebody come and hammer on the aircraft outside and say, dismount, get out, boys, it's all over, you're not going. You've all got 3 days' leave. Well, now, you can't go on doing that to really high-grade, highly motivated, superbly trained troops, where morale is at its peak. You can't go on doing that without morale suffering, and the formation will start to go downhill. And Boy Browning knew this, and so he was prepared to take on rather more than perhaps it was wholly justified. And I would say that a degree of rashness was justified there to avoid the danger that this magnificent fighting force would deteriorate. Well, now, Market Garden had much against it. For one thing, those forces ought not to have been used in that way before the Scheldt was opened. From the beachhead in Normandy, we were still getting all our overland supply. What we wanted was a port 300 miles up the coast, and the forces we used for Market Garden would have been better employed opening the Scheldt, which wasn't open to sea transport until late November, and that was really a great mistake. Secondly, we didn't have enough aircraft to put the whole lot down in one lift. That was important. My brigade was coming in on the second day, and on the second day, all surprise evaporated, and the splendid atmosphere of brandy and bonhomie which surrounded everything went on the first had gone. And indeed, when we dropped in on Monday the 18th of September, our dropping zone was being cleared by a charge by the King's Own Scottish Borderers, and we were in the battle from the word go. Now, an airborne operation needs to come down as complete surprise, and we missed that. Next, we were given as a job the task of defending the northern outskirts of Arnhem City after the bridge had been captured and was being held by the 1st Parachute Brigade. And that was 8 kilometres, 5 miles away from the dropping zone. We were dropped so far away from our objective because the air forces reckoned that they were anything nearer to the anti-aircraft defences of Dalen Airfield would cause heavy, heavy casualties, particularly on the air side. And they were very unwilling to risk it. And so we were dropped too far away. Jim Gavin, one of the best airborne commanders that the world saw, wrote in a book, in planning an airborne operation, if you can't put your force down on top of the objective or very near it, you better rethink the whole thing. And we were going to march 5 miles against opposition, which included armour with such weapons as parachute troops have, which are not all that heavy. And it was going to be very, very difficult. I will only throw in here as well that the weather was very much against us and prohibited the close air supply which we had counted on. And there were other things. Signals weren't too good all the time, although they weren't nearly as bad as many people have claimed. But in regard to the planning, I read a book about my time in Holland in the 4 months I was convalescing after the battle in a house in a village in Holland, Ada, and being looked after by a Christian household of four elderly ladies and the son and daughter of one of them, in a house incidentally next door to a military police, German military police billet, which is evidence of the fortitude and courage of the Dutch. And I had a good deal of time to reflect on this. I'd been badly wounded and was spirited out of a Dutch hospital in German and British joint hands by the Dutch underground, and there I was. Now, I wrote a book about all this called I Was a Stranger, not a surprising title, and put the manuscript away and published it 30 years later. And I remember at a conference of representatives of the publishers when this book was coming out, and one man said to me, it was a pretty doubtful operation, and when did you begin to realize that you weren't onto a good thing at all, that it might all go badly wrong, and indeed probably would. When did you begin to realize that? When in the operation, I said, before it began. And I told him some of my reasons. There was the optimism of 30 Corps. Horrocks was always a great optimist. And the confidence that the tremendous advance across Europe from the Normandy beachhead had given, and a failure to hoist in that ahead of them in this Market Garden operation, there were a bunch of people, the 1st Airborne Division, who were really in desperate straits. And they didn't maintain that degree of urgency in the follow-up that perhaps might have been expected. But this was largely the result of the enormous success of their march across northwestern Europe after the Normandy landings had induced. Well, I also didn't like the intelligence situation. Outre, it appears later, was able to tell us that there was armour in that part of the world, but the optimism of 30 Corps, and particularly Horrocks and his intelligence advisors, that we were up against no very important opposition at all, it was difficult for me to take. My great ally in the command structure of the 1st Airborne Division was the Polish brigade commander, Sosabowski. He and I had plenty of fighting with Germans, and we knew one thing above all others, and that is that however likely a position may be held by the Germans, you threaten anything vital and you can guarantee that their response will be swift and violent. They told us that there were only some ersatz battalions, some officer cadets, some convalescing aged men and a few Mark I tanks, and that's all there was. But they didn't realize what we would be up against when it came to it. Now, what Ultra had been able to indicate was that an armored corps, the remnants of an armored corps, was being moved through that part of the world to refit in Germany. They were weak in tanks, they had little armor, few guns, but they had far more than the 1st Airborne Division could bring against them, and it was only a question of a railway journey for them to be brought up within 24 hours to full strength. There were two armoured divisions moving through there at the time, or at least the cadres of two armoured divisions. And we didn't know this. We were told there were only these few Mark I tanks. Now, Brian Urquhart, the G2I of the 1st British Airborne Corps, the man who, incidentally, after the war, really virtually ran the United Nations until two or three years ago, a great person, he was a bit unhappy about this intelligence situation, so he tacked a couple of reconnaissance, oblique photographic aircraft onto a fighter sweep going across that part of the world just before we went over, a few days, and the photographs revealed something heavier than Mark I light tanks. But so determined was our command to get this lot into action, and I thought, with every good reason, that Brown was prevented from passing this information on. Indeed, he was sent away on sick leave. He was told that he'd been working too hard and needed a rest, and he must go at once for a week's sick leave. He protested against this, but he was bundled off, and so this information never came down to us. And there we were. But I greatly suspected that there was an underestimate of what we would meet when we got there, whatever there was on the ground there right now. And Sosabowski shared my misgivings here. And in the last plan that we abandoned, Operation Comet, which was to be the one we went for before it was cancelled and Market Garden was put on instead, in Comet, the three crossings across the Rhine, the Maas, and the Vaar, which defeated an airborne corps of three airborne divisions plus. This whole operation was going to be undertaken in Operation Comet by one airborne division, ours. And what I had to do with my brigade was something which proved too much in the first instance for a complete American airborne division. Well, our own staffs, who were so good at deploying airborne troops, tended to do was to plan an operation and then add in German opposition to taste. That's what it seemed like to me. And I remember for Comet, Sosabowski, with his deep, gruff voice, when he was told by the commander that this was what was going to happen, in his heavy voice bursting and saying, "But the Germans, General, the Germans." It was a plan which had been made with very little reference to what the German response might be. So the omens were not good. And then the bad luck came after that, the weather, the signals and so on. And this overestimate of German flank opposition. When we finally got through to Delen later, it was found that there was very little flak there, in fact, and the air forces need not have been quite so chary of putting us down onto our objectives. Now, one can go on about this for a long time, but there were mistakes made, but nothing really can withdraw anything from the praise due to the troops who fought in that battle. They were absolutely splendid. And I should always remember lying in that hospital in Arnhem City with the doctors giving me a 50-50 chance of ever emerging from it and hearing troops marching through the streets singing. This was after the withdrawal, and I wondered, was this Second Army at last coming up to relieve us? No. They were British infantry soldiers marching away under guard as prisoners of war. And the great thing about the Arnhem operation was that even when we knew we were beat, we knew we were better. And that, I think, is all I need say to sum up what I've always regarded not so much as a military matter of technical, strategic, tactical, other technical significance, as really what I've always thought of as much more of a spiritual experience. It certainly went very deep into those who took part in it, and as a result, there are many of us who still, 50 years after the event, gather, as surviving officers of the 4th Parachute Brigade did over dinner last week in London, to see their old friends, as many as are still around, and recover some of the feeling that kept them together in those days.
General Hackett would like to correct one thing that he said. He gave the name of the gentleman at Fort Carlisle in the USA as Charlie Borthwick. In fact, it should have been Charles A. Beckwith.